Hello and welcome back to the Patreon bonus feed for Rails to Nowhere. I am, as always, Simon, and joining me is the fantastic Ella.
Hello.
She's always caught out by me introducing her. And today we are back just for you, our fantastic patrons, doing a bonus episode. Today we're talking about two of the biggest names in the 1930s London transport history. Frank Pick and Lord Ashfield. We're also talking a little bit about lost history. So it's going to feed in a little bit on our previous historiography episode as well. Sort of touching on some similar themes, I think, there.
Yes. Before we continue, I will put a preemptive apology if you hear any like construction noise in the background. We've had some new neighbours moving just slightly down the street, and they've got like a digger and all sorts moving around outside. I'm very sorry.
Yeah, hopefully not too much. I can't hear anything, so hopefully it's not coming up through on the mic. So Frank Pick and Lord Ashfield are two of the most significant people in London transport history. Yet again, I find myself saying we don't subscribe to the great man theory of history here in Rails to Nowhere, but we do keep coming back to important personalities, and collectively.
There's a difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a difference between great man theory and key personalities in history.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can talk about great man theory, everyone says about Napoleon, or in this case Pick, or whoever, but I think you have to separate out the fact that these people are often leaders in a time period or significant string pullers, but they're not necessarily the great individual we all make them out to be.
Yes,
and they are dependent on other people, other things, other factors that all play into their ability to be, I think, as we would describe, effective leaders.
Yeah, and I think the important thing is to note that whilst they're the general, so to speak, who is directing what's going on, it's the wider situation that is influencing what they're doing. And I to be honest, on my reading of Frank Pick, I think that's sort of the attitude he would take of his own life, to be honest, that whilst he's the one who's in the position to direct what's being done by the organisation, he's trying to respond to what the social and economic pressures around him are making him need to do, so to speak. So collectively, these two people steer the direction of London transport for almost half a century. It's an incredible period of sort of stability in London's transport leadership, the period from around 1907 through to 1948. And very much they solidify and continue the legacy left to them by Charles Tyson Yerkes in the UERL, and their decisions and actions in many ways still shape the policies and culture of Transport for London through to this day. However, while we know quite a lot about Frank Pick, we know very little about Lord Ashfield, and this is one of the reasons why we're doing them both in one episode. And in today's bonus episode, we are also going to be talking a little bit about the lifetimes and legacies of both of these people, but also about how history gets lost, the holes that that can leave us in the story, and thinking about how we get around those and how we try not to misinterpret history despite those holes existing. So let's start with the man that we know the most about. We're going to start with Frank Pick, and we're just going to talk a little bit about his sort of background, where he comes from, how he gets to be in the underground. So he's born in November 1878, so when you listen to this, it's almost his birthday. So 23rd of November, make a cake for Frank Pick. It's going to be his 150th birthday? 145th birthday. Thank you. I can't do maths.
I can't. I used a computer.
It's going to be his 145th birthday on the 23rd of November. And he was born in Spalding in Lincolnshire, which answers the question that one of me and my friends were asking the other day, which is, what is the purpose of Spalding? I'm allowed to say that. I have family from Lincolnshire. I'm allowed to make fun of it. In fact, I have family in Spalding, I think. The principal resource we're using for Frank Peck's life here is the biography, The Man Who Built London's Transport by Barman. It's not a perfect book, but it's the most comprehensive biography of Peck. But then there's also a load of other books, both about London transport and design more generally, that talk about Peck as well, that we're drawing in, as ever, down in the description for the bibliography. Barman says that Peck's upbringing is really significant for his later life and really instills into him the sense of hard work and doing things properly that would come to play a major role in his processes with the Underground, and really is a defining feature of his career with the UERL and the LPTB. So when Peck is relatively young, his family move from Spalding to York, where Peck is schooled, and following his standard education, he then applies to go to university in Oxford, but he's unsuccessful in that application. And so instead, in 1897, he begins working in the offices of York solicitor George Crombie. Based on this experience, he then applies for a law degree, which he studies for and obtains in 1902. So he's going on to become trained as a lawyer. However, as a bit of a surprise, having obtained his law degree, he decides that he doesn't want to become a solicitor and instead applies to work for the North Eastern Railway, which is one of the major employers in York at the time. And his sister allegedly recalls that no one in his family was quite sure on why he applied for the railway. He'd never shown any sort of interest in trains or anything like that. There's speculation that maybe it was pressure from his father, or potentially that it was just one of the few jobs in York at the time that would employ a graduate, or was looking for graduates to employ, at least. However, what is clear is that Frank Peck was well received by the North Eastern Railway. So he enters the organisation in the newly created Traffic Statistics Office, and this is actually quite a significant office. This time, very few of the railways are actually keeping very good statistics on a lot of what they're doing, and the North Eastern Railway pioneers a variety of new statistical methods that mean that it actually begins to become much more aware of actually what's going on with its operations, which is quite unusual at the time. And very quickly, Frank Peck is moved around the organisation, and not in a sort of, oh, he's terrible, let's just get rid of him way, but actually in a, he is quickly moving up and round divisional offices. So he's quickly moved from York to Sunderland, up to Newcastle, before moving back to head office in York and becoming appointed to personal assistant of George Gibb, the general manager of the North Eastern Railway.
I have a question about the North Eastern Railway here. As you're probably aware, it came up in my research on future railway topics. I wonder if that's why they ended up speaking with the North Eastern Railway, in that this company was looking in this new statistical way.
Yeah, so
they were offering a bit of a consultancy in some ways.
Potentially. I'm not entirely clear exactly what they were doing, but I just know that North Eastern had a different approach, or a more detailed approach to the statistics. And given that Peck's joining their statistics department it very early in its existence, I wonder to what extent Peck has a defining hand in starting that sort of culture. And Gibb is a relatively important person within Britain's railway history. Their name comes up in a variety of locations and a variety of times through a variety of roles. And in 1906, he is appointed as deputy chair for the Underground Group, under Edgar Speyer, who we have mentioned previously when we talked about Yerkes. He'd taken over from the chairmanship of the UERL after Yerkes' death, and Gibb is appointed as his deputy in 1906. Gibb fits the bill for the UERL well, as under the North Eastern Railway, Gibb fits the bill of what the UERL is looking for really well, because under him, the North Eastern Railway was one of Britain's most efficient railways, and he'd been the only railwayman on the recent Royal Commission on Railways, and he was familiar with American practices, so with the UERL being a meld of British and American business and railway practices, Gibb really fits well into that sort of mould that they're looking for. Gibb would then bring Pick with him to continue as his assistant. Clearly, Gibb thinks very highly of Frank Pick in that case, and so he brings him with him to continue being his personal assistant at the UERL, and so Pick moves to London. Some point in 1906 or 1907, it's not quite clear. What is clear is that Pick doesn't move exactly when Gibb does, but a little bit later. It's not entirely clear exactly when Pick... I'm not entirely clear exactly when Pick moves to London. At around the same time as Pick and Gibb are arriving at the UERL, the board of directors has decided that a new position of managing director is needed to be created to manage the day-to-day operations of the organisation. According to Barman's biography on Pick, Stanley Ashfield was born on the 8th of August 1874 in Normanton in Derby as Albert Knatress. I probably should have asked an underground expert. I am an underground expert. I should have asked another underground expert. Pardon?
I think it's Cantress.
Cantress, yeah. I should have asked probably Paul, our guest in the next episode, how he would say that as well, because he's probably got a better idea. And contrary to what I initially said in our episode on Yerkes, he is born to working class parents. His father is a coach painter. And his family have moved from Derby to Detroit in the 1880s. This is where it becomes really sort of unclear because so few records exist on Ashfield's history. But his family moved to Detroit in the 1880s, and his family changed their name to Stanley to sound more English. Unlike Pick, Stanley found himself interested in the Detroit streetcars as he grew up, and despite his family's ambitions that he should take on a career with the church, he turned to the streetcars for his employment. Stanley started his railway career at just 14 years of age, becoming a messenger and then later doing odd jobs for the Detroit Citizens Streetcar Company, and he quickly rises through the organisation, gaining a promotion to the schedules department by the age of 18, and according to the London Transport Museum's website, rising through to superintendent of the whole of Detroit's amalgamated streetcar system at 20. However, I've got conflicting sources on this because Barman puts this as being in 1900, which would make him 26. So we're already finding the limitations on the sources here because I've only got these two sources, and they say that he did very quickly rise to the position of streetcar superintendent. It's unclear as to whether that's when he's 20 or in 1900.
And that's just, unfortunately, I think, going to be a consequence of the particular company he's working in that the Detroit Streetcar Company, the amalgamated company, will eventually disappear under what was the company called that was to buy up the bus company that bought up tramways and shut them down?
Oh, that's a good question.
What it is, it's like something lines.
Something. I can't for the life of me.
You keep going. I will come back.
You're going to, live Ella going onto Wikipedia to check things out. During the Spanish-American War, he serves in the U.S. Navy on the USS Yosemite and sees a limited amount of action in that conflict. And then in the early 1900s, he comes back into public transport, joining the Public Service Corporation of New Jersey, where by 1907, he has risen to the rank of general manager, which he's appointed in January of that year. However, that appointment would not be very long-lasting, as in February, the UERL are able to entice him away to come and become their managing director. And again, like Gibb, Ashfield is of interest to the UERL because he combines British and American business practice and understanding, and his high-flying career and his rapid series of promotions to very senior roles is really interesting. Bearing in mind, born in 1874, he's already managing director of the Underground Group at this point, and he is only just turned sort of 35 at this point, so he's really flying through the ranks of all these organisations.
Before we continue, you can either cut this in later or just leave it as is. The company that was buying up streetcars and turning them into bus routes was National City Lines as part of the General Motors streetcar conspiracy. That's an entire fascinating part of US history too.
That's a whole other episode coming at some point, I'm sure. That's something I kind of do want to write about at some point.
Yes, especially as it's like the Sherman Antitrust Act too, which is a fascinating.
If you'd like to hear the rest of this episode, as well as listen to the rest of our bonus episodes and get a week's early listen to all of our regular episodes, then you can do so by supporting the podcast for just £2 per month over at patreon.com/railstonowhere. A massive thank you to all of our patrons for your support for the podcast. Without you, none of this would be possible. And a special thanks to our £10 patron, Valkyrie Lemons.